Thank you, and I would like to thank the organizers, particularly Eberhard, for inviting me to give this talk. And I have a couple of things to say about this, actually about this slide, particularly addressed to Eberhard. This symbol, it's the logo of the University of Michigan. University of Michigan is where I work. Okay, I just wanted to
it's
get that.
Illinois. It's not Illinois.
It's the University of Michigan.
Yes. Is he my brother-in-law?
His brother-in-law is Mike, in the physics department. He's my colleague. The second thing I want to say is also addressed to Eberhard. This is about a particular model. Notice I used the dreaded word model, this is an example of a situation where what Eberhard told us on Monday is just flatly false. That is to say, this is a situation where we have a model which we hope represents something of interest in pattern formation, in particular in epidemiology is the example I'll use, in ecology, where a partial differential equation is absolutely the wrong thing to do. And that's basically what this talk is about, is that partial differential equations may be a starting point, but they are not necessarily a starting point. Now, this is a little bit old stuff. It's been published twice, once in a special issue of the Brazilian Journal of Physics, and I was sure that no one would ever see it, so we we extended it and published it in Physical Review E. And so let me tell you what the subject is. We're going to be talking about a particular process, a particular stochastic process, which was brought to the attention of the physics community by Mai, Sokoloff, and Blumen. Those of you who heard Dave Kessler's talk, this is what he referred to as the Blumen model. I refer to it as the Sokoloff model when I do refer to it, but we're going to call it MSB, Mai, Sokoloff, and Blumen. And this is a model which is intended to represent a kind of process which is important in certain situations, in chemistry, in epidemiology, in ecology. It's an infection process. There are two kinds of random walkers. And in this model, until the end, until the very end, very second to last slide, I'm going to be talking about things in one dimension because I'm going to want to solve the problem, and one dimension makes it simple enough to solve this analytically. And here's the model. You have two kinds of guys, A's and B's. Okay? The A's you should regard as sick, and the B's you should regard as healthy. And they random walk, and whenever an A encounters a B, like these two guys come together, the B becomes healthy, sick too, and never recovers, and that's the whole thing. That's the whole story. Okay? So, the random walkers on a line have this process, and I'm going to very much simplify the model. This is the version of MSB, where you have exclusion, nearest neighbor, you know, you can't have more than one particle on the site and so forth. I'm going to simplify that in a moment to very, very radically in order to make a soluble model. But okay, this is basically what the idea is. Now, what does this have to do with anything? I mean, maybe it has something to do with excitation transfer in chemistry. The sort of conceit I'm going to use, the metaphor I'm going to use is an infection, a disease. And a classic example is a case of rabies in the United Kingdom, which does not exist. United Kingdom, in all the British Isles, there's no rabies. Now, you may know that rabies is this is exactly, okay, you have mad cows, but no mad dogs, all right? So, the British are, of course, panicked, or were particularly panicked at the time of the opening of the Channel Tunnel, that some nasty Frenchman would bring his pet. Philip tells me that that J.D. Murray says that if someone did that, he would be should be shot, but would bring a rabid pet. Well, actually, I'll let Philip explain.
The story is Jim was doing this while I was a postdoc, and in the local newspaper, a big headline appeared that said, "Shoot dogs of death, says mathematics boffin." So I asked Jim, did you really say this? And he was very angry. He said, "No, I didn't. I said, shoot the people who bring in the dogs."
So anyway, the idea was that the rabid pet would come in, it would infect the wild foxes in Britain, and foxes are territorial, they run around, and this fox would diffuse and see that fox, and that fox would get rabies, and there's no resistance because they've never been exposed to it, and I don't think there is anyway in canines, and would propagate through. And Murray did this classic study of the propagation of rabies across the British Isles. Okay? Now, ecological catastrophes of that sort do happen. For example, Dutch elm disease in this country, mongoose introduction into Hawaii, it does happen. So it's perhaps of some interest, but
I would say also has some common, or today's
informal. Be as informal as you like, Esha.
Did they try to apply it also, for example, for positive things like selling product? That if you have Macintosh and we met here, and now you convinced me to buy a Macintosh.
Actually, someone did something like this for propagation of rumors. Which, you know, is kind of a similar thing. Okay, so what are we going to do? We're going to take a situation where the total concentration is low, because that will give us a small parameter that will allow us to solve the problem. We're going to take, I'll call the total concentration, the number of particles per site on the average, theta, and we're going to solve for small theta, and we're going to find in the low concentration limit the average velocity of propagation is exactly in the limit, the diffusion constant times theta over 2. D is I'm going to take to be 1 in what follows, so that we will, in fact, just find theta over 2 for the velocity. And we'll find that this is a fluctuation-dominated process. Basically, what happens is that you'll have gaps, if the theta is low, you'll have gaps in the concentration, and it's the diffusion across the gap which gives you the velocity. Basically, there's a length scale, 1 over theta, which is mean distance between particles. It gives you a time, and L over T gives you a velocity, and that's rough. And that's numerical analysis, if you will, to get the, you know, sort of a rough argument to get this. Okay, now, but
that assumes that you have diffusion, it's not just holistically put.
Yeah, that's right. The assumption is diffusion. The assumption is everybody's a random walker, as we'll see. Okay, so now, here is precisely the model that we solved, which isn't the same model as my Sokolov and Blumen. To be very precise, we have a leftmost particle of type A along a line. The other particles are of type B. They all randomly walk, and furthermore, they don't see each other. That is to say, you have a collection of n completely independent random walkers. Nothing could be more trivial. They can walk through each other and so forth. Furthermore, I'm going to do parallel updating. It turns out to be technically useful. That is to say, everybody walks at once. Okay. So you have this. You have an A and a B, and they sort of walk. Okay. Now, if they walk onto the same site, this guys were A and B. They'll both be A. Furthermore, in this model, there's a possibility of passing one another. The A goes through the A goes here, and the B goes there. And I'll also then turn it into AA. Okay? So those are the rules. Those are the rules of the game. And we're going to play this game. The rightmost A particle defines the propagation front. We're interested in the velocity of the front. Now, as you can imagine, you can then do this simulation. It's a completely simple simulation. And you do a lot of simulations, and you work out everything. And this is the complete answer. As a function of theta, here is the velocity. And this is the regime down here that we're interested in. And alas, you can't read that. The velocity fits very well. This is just an empirical fit. V is approximately equal. In fact, to a very good approximation, 1 minus e to the minus theta over 2. And of course, for small theta, that goes to theta over 2, which is the result that I propose to derive in a moment.
Is that the number of particles per
site? Yes. Assumed to be less than 1, much less than 1, in this limit.
In what sense do you have the leftmost particle?
Starts out.
The initial conditions are there's an A at site 1.
There
are no other A's, and everybody else is B.
But what are the boundary conditions of 0? Do you have an option to jump to the left?
Yes.
So what you call theta is just half, government population is...
I don't understand the question. There is an option to jump either way, yes.
This is compared to book theory of boundary conditions.
That's the question.
Yeah, right. What happens on the right, you adjoin a few sites, and after a while, it doesn't matter.
That's basically what units of the diffusion constant divided by the lattice constant?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Lattice constant is 1, diffusion constant is 1, characteristic time is 1. Okay? All right, so this is the model.
So it can only jump to the next site, or can it jump long distance?
No. You must jump, okay? There's no probability of staying in the same place. You must jump either left or right, and that's all.
So how do you define the velocity? Because
the velocity is...
But it's a very probably quite random. I mean, it's not...
Yes, but this is the average over 200 realizations, and it's a perfectly... legitimate time series, yes, perfectly legitimate time series.
So what's the fluctuation on that? I mean,
actually, it's not as big as you might expect. I'm just going to deal with the average. I could do the other two.
So for an experimentalist, this is very hard to measure because you can never find this one individual that's on the front. So you find perhaps the 100 in the back, but you don't find the one in the front.
Is there any difference, or do you come up with the same?
No. No. If I look at the midpoint of the A's, it would propagate with the same
speed.
Sure. Everything just moves forward.
It's stationary.
Okay. Now, I want to remind you that this is an essentially trivial model. That is to say, independent random walkers on a line. The distribution of all particles, if you're colorblind, is Poissonian. That's the end of the story. However, if you distinguish between colors, it becomes non-trivial. And that's the whole point. And so we're going to try to talk about this. Now, I will, however, make a slight divergence and say what, my Sokolov and Blumen actually said and what got us interested in this problem. This problem seems to be related to a very famous equation invented by R.A. Fisher. I'll let you contemplate the journal in which he did it, which was kind of in 1937 at that. I mean, oh well. Anyway, he invented this model, and the name of the title of the paper is "The Wave of Advance of Advantageous Genes." Okay, and this model has been used for that. It's been used for that to model that quite reasonably even. Komogorov and collaborators essentially solved the problem in the way I'm going to got the velocity in a way I'm going to describe in a moment. So what is this famous equation? How does it come about? Suppose we assume that theta is not small, but theta is large, or you coarse grain over some large scale or something like that, and you try to write a mean field equation for the concentration of A's. Well, the time derivative of the A concentration has two parts. It has a part associated with conversion of B's to A's, and it has a part due to diffusion, and this is just the good old-fashioned mass action law. Now, in the spirit of mean field, A plus B is a constant, theta, and so you put in for B this thing, and that is the famous Fisher equation. The Fisher equation describes the propagation of a wave from a stable state in this dimensionless form, the stable state at phi equal 1, the normalized density at 1, into an unstable state. Note that when phi is very small, this is just exponential growth of the population. D by T of phi is phi. So you have exponential growth ahead of the wave that you get a phi. Now, because of that, this equation supports traveling waves, and it's the velocity of those traveling waves that I'd like to talk about now. And this is a big it's a big subject, and it's been discussed in many places. And in particular, we've already heard a good deal about it from Dave Kessler, but many of you weren't here, so I'm going to try to keep this self-contained and say a few things about the Fisher equation. So this is by way of divergence. We're going to talk about the Fisher equation. There is a recent, very nice review on ConMath by Deb Panja, which I quite like, and I stole these figures from his review. And so let's just, very quickly run through things that many of you, almost all of you, have seen before. This Fisher-Kolmogorov equation describes a pulled front, that is to say a front, where everything is determined far ahead of the mass of the infected population. How do you see that? Well, you make the usual traveling wave substitution into the equation. You set d by dt, the explicit time dependence, equals zero, and you look at things that are time independent in the moving frame, and you try a solution far ahead of the mass of the infected population, which is just reflects the fact that you have a competition between diffusion and the exponential growth of population. So this turns out to be the right ansatz, and you put it in, and you quickly find, this is completely trivial, that the velocity is related to this decay coefficient of the density by this interesting equation, and that's plotted here, so that below this point, which in the dimensionless form of the equation is v equal 2, you do not have any solutions for real lambda. And you have this double thing, and you have a whole raft of solutions. And what I'm going to try to convince you is that this half doesn't count. This point is special, and this half does count. And that's sort of a well-known formula, a well-known bit of stuff. And that is what Kolmogorov did. That was the original contribution of Kolmogorov. This has led to much mathematical work by quite other extremely eminent mathematicians. The definitive work on this is by Aronson and Weinberger in the 60s, or I think a little earlier, 50s, as I recall. This is a version of the Aronson-Weinberger theorem that I'm about to tell you. There are various ways to see it. But basically, what you say is the following. Suppose we start over here with a wave with this decay constant, which is moving faster than b equal 2. And then, so this is its decay. It looks like this. Now, just imagine that by some perturbation behind the front, you have something which is moving at v star, at this critical velocity, which falls off more slowly. Okay? Now, neglecting diffusion, which would round out this intersection point, you just sort of look at the intersection of the two solutions. Now, this one's moving slower, so this is smaller than this. And if you look at the geometry a while, it means that this intersection point moves down. In effect, the slow solution eats the fast solution, and you end up with all slow solution. Okay? And that's the Aronson-Weinberger theorem.
To call you folks, the pages of
fungi. Yeah, right. Okay, now, in the contrary case, when you're... So all of these points end up down here at the selected velocity. All of these points, when you have very slow decay, you can convince yourselves you eat backwards. These points go up so that you never see the slow solution. You only see the fast solution. Okay, and that's the way it works. Now, this is very beautiful mathematics. I mean, it is, as Eschel says, a long paper. And what Kolmogorov did was somewhat different, but basically, you get this wonderful result. In the original units, I want to point out that this says that the selected velocity is twice the square root of the reaction probability the diffusion constant and this and theta. And that's the result I want to talk about. I'm going to claim now that despite its beauty, this result is completely bogus, that it has, in my opinion, nothing to do with any process in ecology that you might want to describe with it. And the reason is the following. Suppose we plot, make a concentration of the make a plot of the concentration as a function of the distance from Dover, where the nasty Frenchman brought in his pet, into, you know, along some highway, you know, where foxes move. One-dimensional version of England, maybe not so far off. And we're going to try to plot the concentration of foxes. Well, of course, back here you have plenty of foxes, and so you have, say, one fox per unit length and one fox per unit length. And then in here, what do you do? Well, you can have half a fox, quarter fox, tenth of a fox. And basically, when you do the Kolmogorov, you know, this result, what you're doing is talking about the behavior of something. Well, you might get funding for this, actually. That's not as crazy. I mean, that's not as silly as it sounds. What I'm going to show you, I mean, basically the idea, my claim is the following. This equation, because of this funny thing, as we'll see in a moment, it's been pointed out by various people, the Fisher equation is structurally unstable. It is unwise to try to represent natural processes by structurally unstable equations. If you fiddle with the Fisher equation a little bit down here, it completely changes the nature of the solution. That's the point I want to make. So that where the concentration is low, exactly where the things that you neglect in mean field theory are important, like fluctuations, like, you know, other things that might happen, that's exactly where it's most important to get things right. And that's why the Fisher equation breaks down for situations like this. Okay, so now let's go back to the discrete model. And the discrete model is an example of such a matter. What we saw, I wrote it on the blackboard, is that the velocity does not go like theta for small theta. It goes like square root, does not go like the square root of theta. It goes like theta for small theta. The velocity is much, much smaller than you predict. It's in the regime where the Fisher equation has no allowed solutions. All right. Now, part of this was, you know, this was clarified a bit. It's a very beautiful paper by Brunet and Derrida in 97, where they said, now, Bernard Derrida is a genius, and how he came up with this, I don't know. You know, why you would do this is something which, but once you do it, you see it's the right thing to do. Okay, so the point is that you take this growth term, remember the growth term in the Fisher equation, and you replace it by a term with a cutoff. You say that when the foxes are less than a certain average density, they can't reproduce. It's in just pure diffusion. Now, why you should do that, and you should think of this epsilon, this cutoff, since this is a normalized concentration, goes from 0 to 1, as 1 over the concentration. Think of this epsilon cutoff as being 1 fox. And now, here is the surprise. This very tiny change, you know, epsilon can be as small as you like, or theta can be as small as you like, this very tiny change gives a huge correction of the velocity. This correction goes away very, very slowly, very, very slowly as epsilon goes to zero, or as theta goes to infinity, theta goes up. It goes away very, very slowly. That's a reflection of the structural instability of the equation. And now, does this have to do with particle models? Yes, like the one I started talking about. Well, there are models which interpolate between the discrete behavior and the continuum behavior, one of which is Brunet and Derrida is in there. And the reason I said with such feeling that we didn't find this because we were, Dave Kessler and I were working on this subject at the same time and we got scooped. But anyway, we have a model which David talked about earlier in this paper where we, in fact, show the interpolation. And the point is that if the reaction rate is small, that is to say foxes are unlikely, there are a huge number of foxes, let's say mice, there are a huge number of mice, and they're unlikely to infect one another, so they pass through each one another. So the infected ones and the healthy ones overlap a lot, and so you have a nice smooth front. Then you do get, in this very slow manner, you do approach the this result. And that's the subject of these two papers.
You had the K dependence of the leading term, and you're saying now there's a K dependence of the correction term, which is also logarithmic?
Yeah.
So this capital K.
The capital K,
it's a different. I guess it's a different
object, yeah.
Correct. It's a correction, but when you do the ordinary Fisher equation,
yes.
Continuum Fisher equation,
yes,
and you calculate.
Okay, Pierre. Let me say precisely. I think I can answer the question. In dimensionless units, this k is a universal constant, pi square over something two. Okay, and it's independent.
That's for this model, but you're not considering this model. With the theta function.
Let me go on a little bit. Okay. For that model, you get pi square over 2. Then if you put it in ordinary units, you get the whole thing multiplied by the square root of k. Yes? In these discrete simulations that we did and these guys did, you get very close to that same constant. In other words, it's a square root of kd multiplied by this stuff. Okay? So we get, what I'm saying is that this k does not independently depend on the reaction rate.
Where's the small little k?
It's out in front of the whole thing.
That's not a single perturbation. I don't understand. You're saying, I don't understand. What model did Kessler, Ner, and Sanders solve?
Yes, we solved the model where little k goes to 0, theta goes to infinity in such a way that k theta is constant. Okay? And in that case, v is the square root of 2kd kd theta times 2 minus pi square over 2 log square theta. Okay? Yes.
So you're saying that it's unstable when you apply the power there. That this is an unstable, basically, unstable structural thing, unstable equation. So in diffusion equations, if there is an effective and equivalent fast integral formulation for this equation.
Yes.
Like, I guess you can check sort of what is the sensitivity and what is the normalization behavior of this equation, where does it flow to? And probably it flows to the point where the modus is extremely important. It's very relevant. And you can try to see what is the fixed point, what is the differential equation flows to, basically. And so the question is, what is the differential equation flows to?
I will come to that from a completely different point of view, but I will come to that. Yes. Okay.
So let me ask you something. You said that this problem is due to the structural instability of the equation, or is it a problem related to the inability of mean field theories to capture what happens when
it's what he was saying, that if you add a little bit of noise to this equation, as we'll see, it completely changes things.
So it's not a problem of the mean field.
No, it's the same. Those two are the same.
Yeah.
Those two are the same.
the same focus.
You suppress fluctuations, you get the wrong.
It's a form of structural instability. You can either modify the equation a lot by adding certain deterministic perturbations, or by adding noise, because noise couples into those deterministic perturbations.
But if it were a structurally stable equation, you wouldn't have that effect.
Yeah, I'll tell you right now.
You can look at it a different way. The velocity depends on the properties of the fixed point at infinity. So if you change the fixed point, not only if you change, for example, the noise, but even if you change, say that you have an area that the diffusion at plus infinity is different from the diffusion here. Okay, you sit there and you change a little bit, you scale the fox. Let's say that he has these nano foxes, but somebody comes there and scales the foxes. Then it will affect the velocity.
In
this sense, the equation has some fault built into it.
Okay, let me answer the question in another way, which I think is exactly the same thing. What we're really dealing with is exactly sensitivity to noise. Okay, and this equation, which is the stochastic Fisher-Kolmogorov equation, has been studied quite a lot by mathematicians. And particularly, Carl Mueller and Sauers showed that for this equation, the front is compact. It has compact support. That is to say, rather than having this long tail, which we made much of, if you have noise of any size, with probability 1, there will be a place where phi goes to 0, and thereafter there's nothing. You fluctuate to 0, and you don't fluctuate up again. You can't.
How did you get there? I mean, you just fly it down, so I don't think you derive this out of the last equation. How did you get this?
Actually, Herbie did this and got it slightly wrong. He didn't get quite this thing. Charlie Carl Mueller and Peter Smerica have a derivation of this paper, and I have to punt on this. Exactly what they did, I forget.
So somehow the size of the fluctuation with the correlations of the ETAs would somehow include the numbers of the
Yeah, this is multiplicative noise. And it's just saying that if you have no density, you can't fluctuate, right? I mean, the important part is when phi goes to 0. It has to go to 0 that way.
It's like a shot noise. It is like a shot noise in the number. And that shows in a different way why the number, or the fact that you cannot go below some number, is so important.
Okay, so equation was solved numerically in this paper. By the way, Charlie Dering will be here October 3rd, and he'll talk about this.
But no, the epsilon is not arbitrary, right? Epsilon is defined by something.
Yes. We should think of epsilon as 1 over theta.
Or n or something.
Well, I call it theta. Yeah. Yeah. We should think of epsilon for the discrete models, 1 over theta. Yes. But anyway, this has been solved numerically, and you get these dots.
Excuse me, how do they solve this equation numerically? Because when you have these Langevin equations in a limit where you have very low density, it's almost impossible to get anything reliable out of it.
They have invented a very interesting new technique, which I refer you to this paper. But Herbie also, in this paper, they invented a different technique.
Uh-huh.
You're right, it's delicate.
Right.
But it can be handled.
It keeps on going negative.
Sure, that's a point. That's a point, and there are different ways to handle it. A more elaborate one in this paper, where you sort of solve the equation exactly for a very small phi. And in this paper, there's another fix which works. And I agree with you.
Well, there are always issues about whether the equation itself exists and is this working out.
In one, and
so on. Well, yeah. When you have these equations with large noise, sometimes.
Sometimes it doesn't work. This one's fine. In one dimension, in 1 plus 1. In 2 plus 1, then things only exist in distribution and you have to worry about it.
Right. I mean, you're not allowed to put large noise in there. That's
no.
Expansion for weak noise.
Well, no.
Want to bet?
No. You can actually derive those equations from a master equation using field theory.
Yeah.
But then you have to try and take
terms. No. You can show the higher order terms you're about on that.
Anyway. Let me just go on, if I may. the point is that this is the log square correction. Okay? Interpreted this way, or epsilon's 1 over n, the log square correction. Fits over here for weak noise. And for strong noise, this is an analytic result. And you get also nice. And the point that I want to make is the velocity goes like d over epsilon d theta at strong noise in this equation.
What is the noise parameter?
Epsilon?
No, the dimensionless noise parameter. What defines that crossover?
Oh, in this equation, the crossover is at order unity.
Of what?
Of epsilon. This is epsilon. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, eta has unit.
1/time or something.
No, unit.
Unit correlator. Correlator. Yes. Yes.
And so
this
doesn't look like.
This is 10 to the 0 right here.
This is 10 to the 0.
And this is 10 to the minus 2. Sorry about that.
Right. So. I see.
It's another way to view it is to think if you have a theta, which is the average number, you ask yourself if you have a process with a theta and you look at short notes, and you know that the spectrum of the short notes, like in care of current, goes like the standard deviation, square root of n divided by n. And that's
sure.
What brings in the normalization of the noise.
Sure.
The normalization
sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, that's what everyone has been saying.
What does epsilon of 1 mean to the foxes?
It means theta of order unity.
Right, yeah. But if you have so many foxes that you killed one, it doesn't matter.
It's not just still, it's really the problem with small numbers. It's the second problem, I think Kelvin agreed on this.
Right.
Putting epsilon big does not necessarily the same as starting on the stochastic simulation with small numbers.
That's the issue from the property of the equation, not from the translation.
But the epsilon equals one case is totally poorly described by this both assumptions.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm now going to talk about our model, which we solve in I think, an uncontroversial way. And there is nothing really to discuss. The relationship with this and the Fisher equation, we could discuss, but I hope that this is essentially trivial, or a little bit trivial. Okay, so what do we do? Well, remember I said that everything's Poisson distributed, but the point is that the front is a special point. It's not just any point. Okay? And so what we did is we followed the front in the simulation, and we plotted the density at the front, behind the front, and before. Total density on the average in the moving frame. And what we find is that the average density of the particles in back of the front is exactly what you would expect from independent particles, because they're all A's. Okay, so here is theta 0.2, and this is 0.2. The front, of course, has to have more density, because it's by definition got a particle there. Okay, and it's got 1.1, as it turns out. And then you get this interesting thing. It's a depletion zone in front of the front. Okay. And we're going
now
to try to understand.
This is an average of many runs.
Many runs.
With different parameters?
No. It's the same theta, but different random number sequence.
So these are just different realizations.
Different realizations.
With the same parameters.
The same parameter. Or you could just make a very long run. We've done that too.
Right.
Very long run and just keep on averaging. Okay? Mm-hmm.
It means that the point is most of the time stuck by the Poisson fluctuation, by the events of
religion,
so you have
right.
Right.
Do you want to give the rest of the talk? That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. It's stuck behind the Poissonian fluctuations. That's the point. That's the message of this slide.
Then you have to take a very careful regular events.
We'll do it. We'll do it. We're doing it. Okay, now, first thing I want to point out what Sokolov and company did is they said, well, let's look at the velocity. Okay? And you go into the moving frame, and the standard thing, you set this thing to be equal to zero, we're in a steady state, and we have this equation to solve, and the solution to that equation is theta behind the front, and this funny thing in front of the front, and you can already see, since V occurs here, that V is theta over 2 by our simulation. Okay, well, we knew that already. We measured V directly, but so it's consistent with the depletion zone. But something, we're working to order theta. Theta is small, so the point is that on this side, since V is of order theta, this thing is of order theta, multiplied by theta, you get theta squared. So to order theta, you get 0 in front, theta in back. And that's going to be important in what follows. But you don't get V. V is not determined by this analysis. You need a detailed analysis to get V, and here's how we do it. Here are some pictures. The guy in black represents the particle that describes the front. If there are more than one particle on that site, you just pick one at random. And so here are some possibilities for just the red particles. The blues don't count, because the blues will get infected or not as you go along. And so what we do is we consider a region around the front which contains the front particle and one other. Okay. Now, if theta is very small, three particles together, you know, just don't count. The probability is very small. So we can just talk about one particle and one other, and that's why this thing is easy. So the point that I want to make is that the average velocity, the average result of one step of the time is zero in this case, because this guy is as likely to go this way as this way. Doesn't matter if there's a B here, so what? You still have the front here. So the only way the front can advance is if in these two situations. And so let's look at, for example, this situation. With probability 1/4, this guy moves backward, this guy moves forward, so the front doesn't move. You just relabel the particle. With probability 1/4, they both move back, and with probability 1/4, they both move forward. And so the average velocity is this, is 1/4. And you go through and you enumerate all kinds of things. You enumerate this case too, and you find this formula for the average velocity, the average result of one step, given the fact that you have any of these three situations. Either a distant party get nothing, and so here is the answer.
I'm sorry. What is n minus 1?
Is the problem
is where?
At the front. N minus 1 is 1 behind.
Wherever that front.
Wherever that be.
Well, what is that n minus 1?
Where we're going to, that's in the middle. Zero. Here, it's zero.
You didn't tell us whether there was a particle.
No. The box contains exactly two particles. Remember, theta is very small, so with the front particle and one other. And that's all, and with high probability, that's all you're going to see in this box. If we draw a box
of... This box only has one site.
This box only has one site, but...
So what's n minus 1?
Oh, no. We look at a box
surrounded by no A's?
Yeah. I mean, with high probability, if you have these two guys here, there's going to be nothing here. That's the point.
Right, zero.
So, I guess if I miss something, if you're only the red one of the one row already infected, okay?
Yeah.
And they're only making diffusion. So how could you get finite velocity out of it?
That's what I just showed you. There's a finite probability of the front moving forward right here, because yes, and probability is 3/4 of the front moving forward, right? Because they both have to move back in order for neither can move back in order for the front to not advance. The probability of neither moving back is 1/4. Okay, either this one goes forward or this one goes forward. In both cases, the front advances. Yes? Whereas if they both move back, so with probability 1/4, the front recedes. With probability 3/4, it goes forward. So that's the point. That's the point. It's the stuff behind. It's the extra particle which moves the front forward. Otherwise, as you say, it's exactly what you say. Here, nothing happens.
If you change the rules in your model, allow the stuff to stay in, on the same site, right, instead of having to hop forward or hop backwards. You know, are your results depending on the microscopic details of your model?
I expect that the coefficient 1/2 would, but the linearity in theta would not. Okay, now we have to do some dynamics, and you just say you have a random walk. So if the particle is at zero, it can move back, it can move forward, and so forth. Okay, let me, this is best contemplated in the privacy of your room. I think it, in fact, is quite simple.
It's anyway supposed to be exact.
It's exact.
So if anybody thinks it's not exact, they
yeah, absolutely. Challenge. Absolutely. The point of all this, you take all this and put it together in the stationary case, and this is the central result, is that Ni, the probability, the probability density for the second particle, is linear far from the front. It's linear. This defines a linear equation, a linear density. Let me skip that. I mean, it is a linear equation. Okay, it's linear. Okay, so whatever I find for the rest of the talk, I'm going to have to find this linear. And then if you look near the front, you can enumerate things exactly and get the set of equations. Okay, now we still don't know anything, but I will combine the two things I've said. That is to say that near the front, in this box of order whose size is 1 over theta, we know the density precisely and enumerated. And it's got to match to what's outside, which I already told you, which my Sokolov and Blumen wrote down. So it's got to be theta behind and 0 in front. Okay, so it's theta behind and 0 in front. You go back to those equations and nothing, it's perfectly simple to find a solution. Here it is. And then you put that into my velocity constraint, and Bob's your uncle. All right, let's do a little bit more detail.
That's the steepest descent in the field theory of the master equation.
Yes, right. Using Watson's lemma and all kinds of right. Okay, so now
isn't the
stupid descent in the
joke. He'll explain later. all right, now let's look at the total density, because remember we have one more particle, the one that defines the front. And so here it is, here's the answer, and here's the simulation, and here we are. It's of order theta square here, 1 plus theta over 2, exactly 1 plus theta over 2. Yes? This is theta 0.2, this is 1.1, and theta behind. And so we have an exact description of the depletion zone in complete agreement with simulations. Now, so what we have is a velocity, and we see how it arises in detail, how it arises, which is proportional to d theta, not to the square root of d theta. Now, this came up in another way in John Pearson's talk in the calcium symposium, when he also talked about unrelated models, in which, again, you have this same fact that in the continuum limit you have a square root of d, in the low density limit you have, in the discrete limit you have a linear in d. He had exactly that, and this is perhaps related. Now, so I don't know how. Now, this is perhaps too simple for one dimension is perhaps too simple for a map of England. So we decided to go into two dimensions. So maybe there is more to the Murray calculation than I was complaining about. But let me just say what we did. we have no prospect of doing anything analytic in two dimensions. We simply generalize the model to two dimensions in a way which you can find about in this paper. And unfortunately, the color coding of this picture is a little bit different. This is the sick guys, this is the healthy guys. And you get two things. You get a front which advances, and you get a front which wanders. Now, this wandering of the front is something that many people have been interested in for some time. Reardon, Dering, and Ben Avraham talked about some model very similar to this model. My group, in two different papers, talked about a bistable model, a catalysis model, the ZIF model for catalysis. And we found in both cases, in these cases, very accurately, that the wandering of the front is described by the famous KPZ equation. This paper, which is more, it is more like the Fisher universality class, whatever that means for a discrete model, get something which is not quite KPZ. Yes?
I mean, this is effectively a one-dimensional model with one very front, right? I mean, the picture which you have here.
Are we allowed diffusion this way?
I mean, I'm expecting two dimensions if you start with single perturbation and single animal, yeah. Which would get sort of spherical.
That's right. Front. Absolutely. So we started with a sick line.
This is the phone propagation along the channel.
No, along the channel. That's right.
It may have difference of long time asymptotics rather than.
I would be surprised, because if you have a basically circular front, and you look at it a very long time, the curvature result goes away. So I would be surprised if that was true.
The effect on the spectrum of stability was like one over
half. Okay, what we found is that the velocity is not linear in theta, and it's not square root of theta, but something between. We may be seeing a crossover. I don't.
How do you find the velocity?
We collapse the whole thing down, and we've all done this. You have some sort of average thing, and we look at that at the halfway up point. Just, you know, standard. In all these papers, we do that. Same thing.
And how do you define the fluctuations of the
face? Then you know where the front is, and you draw a line, and you look.
Or you just measure the leftmost part of it,
or? Yeah. You just always look for the rightmost black guy, and its position with respect to the line gives you the broadening of the front.
So what's the optical dimension of this model?
No idea. I would expect it's probably four, but I don't know.
It's sort of like direct interpolation, but what's the range you're writing out before?
Yeah. Probably. I suspect that's right. I don't know. Yes.
If you define the front as the rightmost sick animal,
yes,
then it doesn't become really a one-dimensional problem.
No, because it jumps around. You can have this one for a while, and then you'll get one down here.
Yes, even faster increasing, faster growing front.
Yeah. See.
No. But he means then if you define it in the middle. That it depends on where you define. Are you saying the velocity depends on where you define the front? No.
Does not. No, because the broadening of the front is sublinear. That's this. Right? So anything corresponding to moving back and forth in the distribution of animals is going to be a small correction to the overall T behavior. Because this means you go like t to the 1/3, fundamentally. The broadening goes like t to the 1/3.
The mean field here is 1/2, and you're finding 0.6?
Yeah.
So it's already...
It's very close. Yeah.
Very close.
Yeah.
So maybe the upper critical dimension is 3.
Yes.
What's your characteristic entire number of dimensions? Or the particles don't meet, right, the entire number of dimensions. So eventually, at some point, you will just not have a front.
You would not have a model. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, let me just mention how I might nevertheless criticize the foxes in Great Britain argument. Because Great Britain, this is not a map of Great Britain. Great Britain is inhomogeneous. There are no foxes in Piccadilly. So you have, who knows, none of the type that we're describing. And you certainly have blockages, and you probably have essentially one-dimensional corridors along which wildlife propagate their infection. So I would be reasonably sure that at least in some regions where you have genuinely trying to model an epidemic or an ecological catastrophe of this sort, you would have to worry about these discreteness effects a lot. You would have bottlenecks for the propagation. So I think that that's something which is worth thinking about. Okay, so summary. Okay, we have shown this, that the behavior is not like the Fisher equation, but quite different. We have this funny behavior that even though we have a completely trivial model as far as total density goes, as far as density of the different colors, you have something which is quite non-trivial, but you can work out. Here is the main result. I have not talked about the fact that this model for high densities, for theta large, in fact, have a velocity which saturates. That's an artifact of the model, because we have parallel updating, and the fastest you can go is just have the front move one site per time step. And so, just because I had some very good graduate students and they were ambitious, they actually tried to derive this whole formula, and it more or less, we have an approximate derivation of the whole formula for the velocity, but it may be, it's a more specialty of this model, probably not significant for general applications. Thank you.
So how robust is this model to the assumptions that were made? You know, if you lose some of the assumptions that the particles can move through each other, things like that, make it more realistic.
Yeah, low density. My Sokoloff and Blumen got the same result we did, namely linear and theta. And I cannot remember the coefficient, but I think the coefficient is even the same. They used sequential updating. I did parallel updating because it just made everything easy, you know, enumeration easy.
Of course, now make this model much, much more different because in real ecology, there's not just one species usually.
Yeah, sure. You can do all kinds
of the species.
Yeah.
Some travel fast, some travel slow. Yeah. Some like to stick around. Others have big territories that they explore. So there's even another big noise term in the whole problem that there's not just one diffusion constant.
Sure.
There are many.
Yeah.
It's not just jumping discrete on a lattice. It's some flights. There might be some flights. You know, where one animal actually likes to run a lot.
Look, if someone wants to make his...
Actually.
Yeah.
It would be continuously done, right? It would be a discrete lattice.
Well, it could be continuous, but if you keep it discrete, there could be stuff, Levy flights or some type of super diffusion where things really get large.
No, if you have...
It seems to be extremely important for this thing, because if you get some guy who just shoots ahead and jumps on a train and happens to, you know, hitchhikes a car, you know, I mean, that guy is a bad guy, you know?
No, actually...
That's the one that came through the tunnel.
If the foxes, you know, are, you know, whatever, if there are... You know, long distance transport, but they're rare.
Well, like the dogs.
Yeah,
you know,
yes. Yeah,
so, you have the foxes,
you
know, sitting there.
Yeah, and someone and some
from Dover Street,
and some
and somebody has
somebody
dog
puts a dog and carries it up to Scotland, and then
and suddenly you get a new.
So, right. But I don't think, as long as those are rare, I think you can think of just different foci of infection. I mean, why not?
Right, but there's this interplay between.
No, if you add levy flights to it, it'll change it a little bit.
No, but levy flights are not like that. Levy flights are. Power law distribution.
Yeah.
He's saying, you know, have very rare, very long.
Well, I said both. You know, I said really. I also meant the other one, really, the power
distribution. That I'm sure it would. And look, if someone wants to make a life work of this kind of model, I think it's a very rich kind of set of behavior. I should mention one more thing, which I intended to mention. To go back to the high density model, there is another work of Brunet and Derrida, subsequent to this, in which they showed the following, that what happens at the tip, the stochastic processes at the tip, I've claimed, you know, the cutoff at the tip changed everything. So the stochastic processes at the tip are really fundamentally what's happening in a discrete model. And that's what I've described. And what they did is they said, let's just make a stochastic process at the tip and the continuum equation behind. And then that describes the process perfectly well. I mean, that's as good as doing the complete model. Furthermore, all these things that we did where you have to have two particles here or one particle behind and so forth to push the front forward, of course, comes up there. But, of course, what comes up is you have huge numbers. I mean, you know, theta is going to infinity, right? You have to have a lot of processes, and they can't enumerate them exactly, and they do it numerically. But nevertheless, lesson is that the stuff behind which is pushing the front forward is what counts. Yeah.
I want to mention another thing, another perspective to this. You can ask what we learn about the model. You know, what is the upper critical dimension? What is the field theory of the master equation? If you add this kind of noise or not. I think there is another message that Lenny mentioned several times. This is the fact, what can you learn from this model, as Len said, which is the simplest you can imagine. So it shouldn't fit any real life situation in the sense of the details. And if you will add Levy flight, and you'll add multiple Levy on top of Levy flight and so on, it would still not be in agreement with anything in life. But you learn something very crucial from this kind of models. One thing is that if you talk, for example, in medical doctors, that if you treat the way that epidemic works in the very small cases, in his cases, the small noise in the very front, that is the crucial thing. And you can forget from all the scenes of the media or the large density in the front. That's one thing. The other thing is, the deep biological system like bacteria would behave in such manner, there would be all cells in the body that have to migrate, or embryonic development or whatever. They would be so sensitive to what's going on very far in front, and it does make sense. So you realize that they fight it. Now we can see, instead of them, how would they fight it? For example, what kind of thing you can add to such model in the sense not to agree with a specific case, but that it will change the nature of the behavior. For example, one thing that Ben and I are looking at is if you have nonlinear diffusion. Okay, so bacteria, you add nonlinear diffusion, and all of a sudden, you're not so sensitive to what's going on.
So you mean diffusion dependent on density?
Right? Yeah.
For example.
Yeah, superlinear in density.
Yeah.
And then there's no tail, and you have compact support. And things change in an intrinsic way, a fundamental way, which we like, sort of, you know, even though in the case we're dealing with, it may or may not be closely related to the biology.
So that case, since you said, you know, that everything is part of differential equations, so in that case, for example, is the discreteness still absolutely essential?
Not if we put nonlinear diffusion.
Right, not. So we're back to where started.
Well, look.
So not everything. I agree with you.
You have to go through this in order to see why they have to use this.
Well, I agree with that.
Because
at the end, where we land,
the bacteria erupted in 3.5 billion years ago, so you'd be satisfied with partial differential equations.
I like PDEs.
They're
fun,
them, you know?
But yes.
I think it's worth mentioning. There's a paper in BMS which came last year. It's about front propagation of rabies in New England area, and it's based on data. But they also have a model in the paper where they show that the expected places where the front should be given where it started and where it is according to data are different. So we wanted to find out what is it that has slowed down the advance of that. And it's very nice because they find out that there's some geographical obstacles, like a river or something there. And they really beautifully compare.
Like, oh, I see. That's interesting.
How, what should be expected from it and what is it that it is now? And they have a beautiful model.
Okay, so I see.
We always need papers for trolling clubs. So this could
maybe that would be a good one.
It would be a good trolling club paper to talk about.
Could you talk about it in journal club?
No, the journal club. You just lead a discussion. Just lead a discussion. Yeah.
That would be a
I want to reflect on the nanofoxes that you mentioned. Now that it's too old slant. In England, I think it was a mistake to say that you cannot have a fraction of a fox. Because if you were to say, because if in your model what you include is not the foxes themselves, but the activity of people running after foxes to hunt them, then you could measure a fraction of a fox because it goes by their expectation to find a fox.
Right.
Then you have a partial differential equation, which really is
for hunt clubs.
Yeah.
I wonder, did you also compare to the discrete problem? Because you said you have a discrete problem and you compare it to the continuous PG, but there are also results about waves and discretized problems. And for instance, in bistable situations, at least the spatial discretization slows down the wave in a very specific
manner. Yeah. Well, the point, you're right, but we didn't know that ahead of time. The point here is that this system is probably behaving like a bistable system, even though if you try to formulate a mean field theory, it doesn't look like that. This discreteness behavior ultimately, and in a very, very specific but and a little bit abstract way, means that the front velocity here behaves like the bistable problem, even though it shouldn't. I mean, why do I say that? In the bistable problem, if you put an infected particle somewhere, it has a certain probability, not zero, of starting an infection. But here, the probability is taken to be unity. Yes? So you might say, that's why we're led to the Fisher equation, which is propagation into an unstable state. However, when you examine the properties of the equation, for example, of Brunet and Derrida with the cutoff, you find that in many ways it resembles bistable behavior. For example, there's something called velocity, I want to say velocity selection, but it isn't the right word. The question is you start with some initial condition and you start measuring the velocity. Of course, it isn't the selected velocity immediately. It's a function of time. It goes towards this selected velocity. And the corrections in the Fisher equation are like 1 over t. Whereas in bistable, it's like e to the minus gamma t, where gamma is the sort of depth of the well. And what you find for the cutoff equation is more like e to the minus gamma t, where gamma depends on epsilon.
I'm sorry, when you said the discrete system, you meant the deterministic discrete system.
Yeah, I was wondering, okay, we had one.
There are two things here. One is the discretization.
Yes.
And the other is the noise. And you're saying, even forgetting about the noise, what about the deterministic discrete system? And that's what
I've been talking about. The deterministic discrete system, which is bistable, has some properties, unexpected properties, in common with the cutoff Fisher equation. So, and furthermore, well, okay, that's what
it's only surprising because, I mean, if you would just increase, you know, it seemed to me like it's the limit, you know, you go to one limit where you go from 90% infected to 100% infections, right? There's a certain limit. It just increases how A gets infected by B. And you said when you go to 1, then you are at the amount because everybody gets infected. So it seems to me like you go over this limit of the bistable system, no? Is it something wrong? It's just that there is a limit.
Perhaps. I didn't quite follow what you said.
Okay.
But it is a question, what do you get if you put noise equal to zero. Mm-hmm. I mean, that should be a well-defined, well, you're saying you don't have noise. Yeah, I'm sorry.
In the discrete model, I have explicit noise, of course. I mean, that's a stochastic process.
So you're saying this, what?
No, I'm wondering just because there's also an influence on of this discreteness. And in some cases, I mean, I don't think that this completely.
Well, look.
What deterministic discrete model?
There's a control of sometimes. There's a control of what the influence on the way.
Difference.
Oh, I see. No. Look, for a bistable system, I should have said this, you know, from the outset. For this equation, for the Fisher equation, discreteness makes a huge difference. If you compare a difference equation.
What would you get for the discrete Fisher equation with no fusion?
You mean just a difference equation?
A difference equation.
You mean. Yes. Different equation for the continuum model. That
yeah, you would
not
get
a
yeah.
straight model.
I don't.
Yes,
I'm
yes
not
the there. Difference equation is a discretization.
Yeah, but I don't. I. The answer is you would get something in that looks very much like continuum Fisher.
So like the Fisher, we did. Yeah.
Because in fact.
No, there's only. There's
you have to make a distinction between discretization and quantization. That's your model to understand it just.
That.
Discretization means you have space points.
Yes.
The quantization means that you have
exactly.
And which did you mean?
Discretization. In no case does discretization make a big difference.
No.
These are not numerically stiff equations. You can solve them numerically. Pardon me? Yeah, but not. She's talking about lattice trapping.
No, you don't have it.
You don't have, yeah.
We didn't have any simulations of this kind. We don't have it.
No, I think the answer is that the discretization.
Discretization. No, but what I was starting to say was quantization, it was a good way to put it. Quantization makes very little difference for a bistable system.
No, but for the Fisher
system. For the Fisher system, quantization makes a huge difference. Yeah. That's the difference.
Discretization, even if you add a large noise, it hardly affects the velocity. If you take the Fisher and you do discretization in space and you add very large noise, it hardly affects the velocity.
It seems pretty mysterious. The only effect of this noise, as you said, was to introduce this cutoff, basically this sort of deterministic cutoff. Okay. If you go to the two-dimensional case, can you make any progress by making a similar sort of assumption?
I don't know because
it wouldn't be as simple as what
it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be as simple and
some power law.
It has been done in a yes, not quite the same system, but it has been done by Levine and Kessler. They've introduced cutoff in a 2D system, and they were looking for front instabilities. It's a somewhat long story. I mean, the question, this was sort of inspired by Eschol's experiments on bacteria, where you see diffusive instabilities. But you write the Fisher equation, and you say the growth rate depends on the arrival of nutrient. You find that that equation is not unstable, doesn't have a diffusive instability. It's stable. It in fact heals. And the reason is presumably because you determine the velocity so far in front that the inhomogeneities in the diffusion field due to a little bump are healed, and so nothing happens. So, and that's a puzzle. And, you know, how do you model these bacteria? Well, one way is what Eschol was talking about before with this compact support from nonlinear diffusion, but another way is to introduce cutoff. In other words, just take that same driven diffusion Fisher equation with where the multiplication rate depends on the nutrient, yes, and then use the Derrida cutoff, and then you do get a diffusive instability.
Well, how complete a description of the system is it to introduce this cutoff and just take the noise out? And presumably, you do lose things.
Look, that's what we're all wondering.
Yeah, that's what.
That's the whole point. As far as the velocity goes, that stochastic Fisher equation and the Derrida cutoff agree. Yeah. You know, at least in the weak noise limit, they agree just fine. Okay. We can analytically, or Mueller and During and Smerica, can analytically treat the Stochastic-Fisher equation in the strong noise limit, but not in the weak noise limit. We don't know how to do that. So we don't know, but presumably the numerics is correct. But we don't know where it comes from. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And in two dimensions, if you're, you know, we don't know. I mean, you know, that Stochastic-Fisher equation, as we've discussed, is not really well defined. You have to cut off the noise, or you get something which is not defined.
Down the field first, just to understand why, you know, why this happens. You're a bit behind that calculation.
So. Yeah. I mean, look, there are.
That you will understand only one thing. If you go to 2D and this is the more interesting case, and you have a form and you want to understand the stability of the forms now, well, maybe you know. You go to 2D. I don't know how to do field theory to a 2D forms and get for me something that you can get any intuition.
But I think the problem is you have to expand around some sort of mean field front. I think that there is an expression for the front of mean field theory.
That's linear stability. That's not doing the mean field that you ask to do for the master equation or the model in 2D. That's two linear stability of the front, and that we know how to do.
No, we're not really talking about linear stability analysis. I'm talking about doing a field theoretic analysis. But the problem with that would be that the ingredients that were going to doing the field theory would be the mean field front. Now that would give you
what
the green function.
He's saying you have to expand around something.
You have to expand around something. You expand around the mean field theory. That's what you do in field theory, right? At least in this
case. Yeah, but how do you know how to do expansion around the if you do a field theory for the front and you don't treat the front now as a string, okay? And if you do the usual thing.
Sure, there'll be like nodes which are sort of transverse to the mean field.
It's not an interface. Well, SO thing is not an interface theory, right? There's structure in that front. And that multiplies the problems.
Yeah, sure, but I'm not talking about doing this.
You can translate the master equation into some sort of field.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. You do the master equation, you do go through its coherence state representation, map it to a field theory.
The second point equation will be the PD.
Yeah.
And the real question is how to get the one of the Lorentz expansion around this third-order equation. And in order to do that, you have to come with some non-portative idea, like, you know,
that's a very nice, depends what you want to do with that. That's excellent exercise. Next time I will teach field theory, which I don't, I give it as an exercise. But the question, what you're looking after, look, that's a good question for example, right? Traditional choice. But we had a case in Israel that they gave in mathematics open question that they had multiple choice. The lecturer forced to give multiple choice, so he gave three questions and two were open, not like Fermat, but and one of the people in the class solved one of these problems.
Absent such a miracle, I think the answer is nobody knows how to do it.
Yeah,
but what are you looking for? To see if the front is stable or to get a fancy description of problem?
You could do things like try to understand what's the form of the tail in the front, right? I mean, does it acquire some interesting power?
Well, let me just say something. I mean, maybe I already mentioned this, but I mean, there is no tail for the stochastic. I mean, the stochastic PDE in 1D, that's equivalent to the field theory. There is no tail. It's compact support.
It's compact for which model, sorry?
The stochastic Fisher equation, the one I wrote down. With probability unity, there is a point beyond which, and this is a theorem, the theorem of Mueller and Sowers, beyond which phi is exactly zero. It's probability unity. And there's
so
finite velocity
in one dimension.
In one dimension.
Ah, well.
I still fail to understand what you look for. What are you after? What do you try to understand? The field theory behavior of this kind of models?
Yeah.
That's what you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, try to understand how the fluctuations change the properties.
Wait. I'm trying to understand. And yeah. Once you understand this, what will you understand? Let's say that you solve this problem.
Yeah. Well, we try to understand like the results you had in two dimensions. Where this thing is fluctuating, you know, and it's
what result? Why it's unstable?
No. You showed this result where it were of the exponents in this two-dimensional interface. Yeah. How do you compute those exponents?
Well, look. I started to talk about this weak velocity selection, strong velocity selection. There's an argument due to karma and others that if you have this exponential approach to the velocity that you know the selected velocity, which is characteristic of bistable systems, then you can more or less rigorously reduce the theory to an interface theory. Okay. And look at the wandering of that interface, and that's KPZ, and that's perfectly well understood field theory. Okay, so if we could somehow convince ourselves that in 2D we had this strong velocity selection, I don't like that word because we use it two different ways, but never mind. Then you could probably just say, okay, fine, we end up with KPZ. And there's a big discussion about this. Tripathi and Fonsarlo said a paper saying that in 2D Fisher equation would, you know, this kind of problem would not be KPZ. Okay, and it was supposed to be KPZ in one higher dimension or something like that. But they've withdrawn that argument now. So, yeah. But as I say, there's a discussion, but I think the most likely way you could get through this would be to find a reduction to an interface theory. And then that's one less dimension, and furthermore, well studied, and you know what to do.
Very convincing, because there's still it's something. People just come to the institute, they need to do field theory. So we talked about it later.
I'm sorry, I'm used to the field theory.
Yeah. So I tell you something about field theory. We looked at it because, you know, nowadays it's nice. Sometimes it gives you powerful things if you do it. Now, seriously, the field theory. When we looked at the Fisher already 1D long time when I was a postdoc here, and of course we did try to do the field theory, try to look at what you can get, and try to understand what the difference in the field theory for doing something like the Fisher, that it's unstable, then say, versus bistable that gives you a solid term. That you can use the ordinary intuition from field theory, okay? And there is a very big difference. And if you try to do the field theory for a case that you have something like the form of the Karman Fisher equation, that you have a soft mode, because you have a continuous family of possible solutions, the entire description in field theory changes quite dramatically. Maybe there is a way to handle it, but at that time, eventually we gave up, and simpler seeing gave us understanding.
I want to come back. I mean, there was another question about what a field theory is good for. So if we have this, what could we learn from them for the problem? But if we go to two dimensions, you know, if we go to two dimensions in your problem, you know, what we find out is that it doesn't behave that significantly different. And so the interesting part
does it?
No. It's no longer linear. It's closer to mean field.
It's closer to mean field, but...
No, right, that's what I mean. So I come and I'm dumb, so I don't know about that it's discrete. I come from mean field, right? And so I just ignore discreteness, and I say I do mean field, and I say, oh, that works quite well. I'm quite happy.
You're saying it's not very different from
mean field. I'm saying
it is very different from one dimension.
So the really interesting part now is to go into the limit and find out whether networks and whether the system as you suggested is actually that there are corridors where things get propagated, where things actually are strongly influenced.
Absolutely, I agree. And that is a much more physical question. That's a much more physical question. Yeah.
Right, and that's the
in other contexts,
otherwise ecologists are quite happy with a half.
Yeah.
And you know
No. But I think it does make sense to ask whether you can understand the two dimensional behavior.
Well, I agree.
It's merely mean field, apparently numerically in this case. And the question is whether there is some systematic understanding of this simplest.
Right, so for me, the mean field theory, the field theory approach that was suggested is exactly trying to do that, no?
Yeah.
So, but that's goes now. I mean, these are two questions,
well,
right?
And if you look at 2D, the 2D gives you less dependence on the quantization, because now we have these two things. And it's, in some sense, easy to understand it intuitively, because then you are less sensitive to a nanoflux in the form, because you have other nanoflux in the y direction.
Okay. So, that,
so each point you can see in some sense that it's sort of other, you have the additional dimension. If you go to 3D, I believe that if you go to 4D now, it's probably will be almost not sensitive to this quantization.
So that's certainly a kind of question one might want.
Sure. I think there's.
You understand.
Yeah, and that you might be able to understand using field theory, near this special field point.
Right.
I mean, it's all mentioned being a one over n expansion. Just do an epsilon expansion around 4D.
Well, the first,
you have to first convince yourself.
But you should convince yourself by doing these mappings to the
The
problem is that naive population theory doesn't work. You have to come with diagram system in order to get this thing. So you should come with a non-perturbative. How to capture the leading one?
What's the problem with expanding around your dimension?
You don't want to do the expansion in what you want to do. If you look in terms of field theory and you go to upper dimension, is that you have a problem of connecting trajectory between two fixed points. And now you go to a higher dimension, and the question is, what happens if you have a situation that one fixed point has all the vectors going in? Or they have one which is all of them going in and one which is going out, the condition of connecting the solid. It's a non-linear.
When you're talking about dimension, it's dimension in the reactant space, not in the real space.
What?
Just in order to understand you're talking about dimensions in the reactant space, not in the real space.
Yeah. I'm talking in the real space. And in some cases, you go also to the reactant space. And what you want to see is the change in nature of the fixed point. When you have bistable, you go like this. If you have the cutoff, you go like this. If you have unstable, you go this way. Then you have the zero. Then you have the bistable that goes like this.
You're in phase space now.
What?
You're not in real space. You're in phase space.
Yeah, now I'm in phase space. Now you go to the field theory, and you have to do the analysis around this fixed point and see if you increase the dimension, if in some case the effect of the fact that you have the cutoff that makes you stay becomes weaker and weaker. Okay? Converges. Okay. Some Victorian point.
I'm surprised that this hasn't been
Well, yes, I'm saying that. The person who's done the most work on this is Fonsarlos, and
he has this huge review that's almost 300 pages long.
But these things are not sorted out. No. There's this review by Panja is more pointed to this question. It has more to do with the stochastic case, and has many interesting things in it, but not the matters that we've been discussing.
One of the interesting points, I don't know whether you're interested in doing this, but if you went back to the one-dimensional case and went back to what we said earlier about the Levy flights and added Levy flights into the one-dimensional case, the one you could do then is basically by tuning the Levy parameter, you can cause the system to mix more or less. Mm. So basically, you get control over what the sort of size of the fluctuations in the system by controlling this Levy index,
mm-hmm.
and you can tune it all the way from having mean field theory having full fluctuation behavior if you have a short range hop. So you can maybe stay in one dimension, but by changing the Levy index, get the kind of full range of fluctuation mm-hmm. behavior as you change that.
And you might, for example, hope for a critical index. An index above which it's mean field and below.
I mean, there should certainly be that. If you make it long range enough, then it's completely mean field theory again. And you could do all this in one dimension without going to higher dimensions.
Right.
So it might make it easier to do something.
Right. It's like long range force.
Exactly. It's nice to be. But you stay in one dimension. So the only thing that will be unclear then is
how much of the higher dimensional behavior you're capturing. So you don't have any transverse modes, obviously, because we're stuck in one dimension.
Right.
But it might be another way of getting a handle on the problem.
Mm-hmm. That if you have level flight, it relates to some extent to the work with Kessler and Levine did in the case of evolution. Because then what you have, that you have in the space of mutation, they have something that pops in a Levy flight. It's like having an affected fox pops further away in.
No. I mean, what's different about that evolution model is that the multiplication gets, you know, depends on space. The rate of k depends on x. Yeah.
Here you translate, and that's why I say that it's super unstable.
It's super unstable if k depends on x. K is proportional to x.
The Levy is weaker case, but if you have Levy, don't you have the case that you have a fox?
I don't think it's the same thing. They still have a local diffusion.
I said that this case of the Levy seems to be between this case that you describe.
Oh, I see.
The case of the T, because in this case you can also increase the K as you said, when the fox jumps further in, it has a faster rate of infecting other foxes.
Yes. Yes.
Which makes it even...
It makes it a completely horrible problem.
You have this suggestion that you have foxes jumping in. It seems that the discreteness should be even more sensitive to the quantization.
By the way, that's a case, you know, leaving aside the question of the super instability, these evolution models are cases where it is naturally one-dimensional. You're walking down the genome or something. And that's been... There's been work by Cy Levin, I think, on sort of mutations in influenza, where it's similar kinds of things, you know, like going back to the original Fisher ideas, where, you know, it's discrete and it's one-dimensional, and he's writing down things that sort of look like Fisher, which... All right, say who?
I don't know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know that part. No.
Okay.